Good morning. Thank you. This morning, we are excited to be talking about the state of manufacturing in Central New York, but I wanted to give you a heads up about the next few weeks of programming. You'll be seeing a schedule very shortly. But for now, I can tell you that next week, we will be talking about the Onondaga County Water Authority. I think I mentioned that to you before, controls the supply of water in Central New York, and we'll find out more about that. Very important, obviously, resource, and also an agency that has ramifications for a lot of other things that happen in Central New York. So we'll be talking to Michael Hooker next week. In 2 weeks, we will be talking to folks from the town/village of Seneca Falls. You may have heard that last week the village voted to dissolve. It was a very close vote. It was contentious, but it did pass by a narrow margin, and so we have the town supervisor of the town of Seneca Falls and also the chair of the village dissolution committee who will be coming to talk to us about that process and where do they go from here. In 3 weeks, Mayor Stephanie Miner will be here to talk to us about pretty much the first 100 days or so of her administration. The week after that will be Earth Day, and we will be talking about hydrofracking. So all of these things, the next four weeks for you to be boning up on. But for now, it's my pleasure to introduce Stanford Perry, TMR member and executive director of ARC of Onondaga, who will introduce today's guest speaker. Thank you, Stanford.
It's my pleasure to introduce Randall Wolken, the president of the Manufacturers Association of Central New York, better known as MACNY. MACNY, as you may know, is the largest association, employer-based association of manufacturers in this region, serving about 19 counties in upstate New York, about 330 companies with about 55,000 employees. So Randy and his staff are very busy providing human services opportunities, support, networking opportunities, information sharing, public policy advocacy, as well as political advocacy for all of its members. As a result of their hard work and his hard work and leadership, MACNY continues to place manufacturing in the forefront of our community, our policymakers, our legislators, to ensure that manufacturing always has a place at the table. Randy was also recently elected president of the Manufacturers Alliance of New York, which represents about 1,000 manufacturers throughout the state of New York. He's a graduate of West Point and also a graduate of the Maxwell School here at SU. Randy also lives in the city and is a proud father of three girls that he and his wife, Denise, are raising. With that, it is my pleasure to introduce to you the president of the Manufacturers Association of Central New York, Randall Wolken.
Thank you, Stanford. Stanford's on my board, so it's always nice to hear nice things from him. Thank you. And I'm really glad that my talk is this morning and not tonight. Very well attended, thank you, but I think there might be one person here if I was here tonight, and we'd all be watching it on the big screen. So go SU. What I'm going to need is this morning I get to talk about my second favorite topic. Manufacturing. My family is my first favorite topic, but I'm really looking forward to having this conversation, in part because of all the misconceptions of what's going on in manufacturing today and all the doom and gloom that's talked about in manufacturing. I spent a lot of time talking about the good things and the great things that are happening not only in our community but across the state and the country when it comes to manufacturing. And when I share some of the thoughts and some of the statistics and facts with you, I think you'll see that it's not all doom and gloom. In fact, there's a lot of brightness and hope and tremendous strength in the manufacturing sector, not only here in Central New York, but across the country. And so I'm going to dive right into that and talk about what we're going to do today. Tell a little bit about the current state of manufacturing, the opportunities within manufacturing, and then what do we need to do to be more successful or to continue to be successful in manufacturing. And then I'll take your questions and I'll try to give you answers. This is a little bit hard to read, so I'll give it out for you. I tried to pack probably too much information into one slide, but you need to understand that manufacturing still is really the driver of our GDP. It's about a sixth of the GDP and 71% of all the exports. So if you want to grow the economy, growing manufacturing is the quickest and the most surefire way. It does lead the nation when it comes to growth. Two-thirds of all the business sector R&D and 90% of the U.S. patents come from the manufacturing sector. So if you're talking about innovation, it usually starts in the manufacturing sector and makes its way to the other sectors, such as healthcare and the service sector. A quarter of the nation's growth, and has been pretty consistent for the last 25 years, has been in manufacturing. Again, despite all the doom and gloom, it continues to be the engine for our growth. It accounts for a quarter. The U.S. accounts for, one-fifth of the manufacturing output globally, and it's about the same percentage as it has been for two decades. So despite all the headlines, it continues to be the most robust sector in the world when it comes to manufacturing. If it were an economy, it would be the eighth largest economy in the world. So the U.S. manufacturing sector is not only not gone, it is a very robust and important sector to our economy. What does it mean for New York State? About 482,000 jobs are in manufacturing directly in New York State, and for every one of those manufacturing jobs, there's typically three connected jobs. So you can see its importance to New York State. We're still in the top 10 manufacturing states in the country. That accounts for 296,000 manufacturing jobs in upstate, and about 40,000 of them here in the Syracuse-Utica-Rome area, and about another 20,000 of them in Binghamton. It's about half the upstate economy, directly and indirectly. So you can see that the health of the manufacturing sector really drives the health of our community. Its annual payroll is over $30 billion. It contributes $69 billion to the New York State economy, and it pays significantly higher than other sectors. So despite, like you said, all the headlines you've read, it is a very big part of the economy, often hidden, often not talked about, but incredibly important to New York State. This is, again, not an easy slide to read, but it will show you that in the U.S., manufacturing, which is the top bar, is the leading contributor to GDP growth. And business services, business professional services is second, but by a large margin, it dwarfs most sectors in the economy. This one shows the top line is the U.S. Since 1986 through this last period of time, which they show about 2006, but it hasn't changed much since then. U.S. manufacturing output to the global output has remained approximately the same. Went from about 24% of the global output to about 21%. The real change in manufacturing has actually happened in Asia, where the second line from the top used to be Japan, and now it's become the third leading manufacturer in the globe, and China has become number two. So China's growth has really been taken primarily out of the Japanese and not the U.S. What's interesting is that still the top five manufacturing countries are still the top five manufacturing countries even after two decades. So not as much change as you might imagine. What's happened is all the sectors, to including manufacturers, and especially manufacturing sectors, become incredibly more productive. More and more work is done with greater capital and less labor, and every one of those labor jobs have become more technical. So a big transformation in the sector, but a lot of change globally, at least in the short term. So what's going on with manufacturers? Well, there are four real challenges that every manufacturer faces, and some of you face it in your businesses too if you're in the other sectors. You have very little pricing power. That is, the ability to pass on wage increases or other kinds of increases are almost non-existent. You have to find a way to be more productive to sell your product. And that's too because of the global market. And yet you've got rising costs for regulations, healthcare, and energy. And I'll talk a little bit more about the issues that confront manufacturers. We do a survey every year, and I'll tell you what they're thinking. There's really a need for a level playing field internationally. What we've seen is there is a good deal of conversation about fair and free trade, but not a lot of fair and free trade. And the reality is that is really a big hindrance to exporting, and it obviously drives our imports up. So we'll talk a little more about that. And, of course, significant and tremendous workforce needs. And I feel, quite frankly, this is the biggest crisis confronting manufacturing. Though the other items will obviously play an impact, enforce changes, if we can't find the workforce necessary to be productive, these companies won't be here in Central New York. And I think it's really the looming crisis ahead of us. So let's talk a little bit about cost. If you compare the United States to the other industrialized economies, we're relatively competitive when it comes to production cost, that is the sort of general production cost. Where we aren't as competitive is when it comes to other burdens that we place on manufacturers. When it comes to health care, other types of taxation and regulation, we do much worse. So it makes us less competitive. And you can see it especially so if you compare us to Mexico and China, where those costs aren't imposed and the production costs are less. So what I like to say is like running a 100-yard dash and they start at the 50-yard line. They start out ahead, so you've got to do a lot of catch-up in order to make it work. And our manufacturers do that, but they do start out behind. And then you throw on the burden of New York State, which makes it even more difficult. And these are just, you know, national averages. Our workers' comp case cost is 72% above the national average. Electricity cost 57% above the national average. And on and on and on. So the reality is we get to be number one in all the wrong categories. And that's really one of the things we're fighting to do is to moderate these cost differentials. How do we lower the cost of energy? And we do have proposals and plans, and we're hoping to actually see one get through the legislature this year for a long-term electrical power program that would really help manufacturers. So we have some light at the end of the tunnel, but all these issues we remain focused on because they make us less competitive. And as companies consider where they're going to expand or where they might relocate to our state, they take these costs into consideration. The impact of doing that, of course, is you reduce the amount of high-skilled manufacturing job growth. The U.S. has seen a significant job growth in that area, New York State, at least through the period that we had some relative recent data, we saw a significant loss. So one of my biggest fears is we're not growing as fast, we're not growing. I'll talk about growth areas, and I think we can, and we do grow, but this is one of the impacts of having higher costs. So what kind of impacts at the national level are there when it comes to trade? The U.S. now is the number two manufacturing exporter in the world. We were number one for many, many years. And now we're number two. China, which is the third country over, is the third leading exporter in the world. And Germany, believe it or not, is number one. So you don't need to be a huge country to be a major exporter. We can learn a lot from the Germans when it comes to exporting, and they've built an entire economy around high-tech manufacturing. And we are still not, we are still obviously a very powerful force when it comes to exporting, and it's really our exports that brings new wealth both into our community and into the country. So export growth and the president's proposal to double exports is a great initiative. Now we just need to make it happen. Let's talk about our trading deficits. Where are they and who are they with? They're primarily with Asia. In fact, they're primarily with countries we do not have trade agreements with. We need solid trade agreements that open their markets to our manufacturers, and we need them with countries like China. 38% of our trade deficit is with China alone. And China really is the sleeping giant here, and we need to come to grips with having good and honest and fair trade agreements with them. If we had open exports into China, there's been some estimates. When they were brought into the WTO, there was a great belief that we'd see a dramatic increase in our exports to that country. We haven't. And there's a whole series of barriers that have to be lowered, and we need honest and hard trade agreements, as well as real good conversations about how do we open those markets to our manufacturers in our exporting. We should have seen probably twice the amount of growth that we've seen so far. I want to move on now to what I think is probably the looming crisis for manufacturing. I'm hearing it day in and day out, even in a tough economy where we can't find the skilled labor we need. And a lot of it has to do with the shift in the needs of manufacturers as well as the rest of the jobs in our community. It shows you really a chart from 1956 and 2005. You know, what kind of jobs are out there and where do we need them? And in 1956, 60% of the jobs were unskilled jobs. You basically could get them with a minimum amount of skill level, even sometimes without a high school education. And about 20% of the jobs are in professional and 20% were skilled. And what we've seen here is a dramatic shift to skilled jobs without a dramatic shift to the professionals. So the reality is we need a lot more young people going into skilled trades and having 2-year advanced degrees We probably don't need a whole lot more doctors and lawyers, though my wife is a doctor and they all do great work. The reality is we need a lot more skilled laborers, and this is something that we are going to need to retool in our educational system. The jobs are in for skilled labor, math, science focused, and that is a big problem for the future of our country. In fact, if you look at where ninth graders are heading, interesting statistics here, you know, we see that where the jobs are is in the gray, the second one down, and where the ninth graders are heading is the green bar. So 28% of ninth graders are heading to college, and we need about 20% of them. We have about 22% heading in for associate degrees and advanced training, where we need 65% of them. And, of course, the big scourge, I think, of our communities is that, 40% of them aren't going to have the skills they need. We have about 15% of the jobs there. So we need some dramatic shifts in where young people are heading for us to have the workforce for the 21st century. And this is, again, I think, the looming crisis ahead of us. It's even worse than all the other cost issues that I've talked about or other export or import problems that we're having in terms of growing our sectors. It's really, will we have the workforce for them to stay in our own community? And the communities that figure this out nationally are going to win, because that's where the employers are going to go, and that's where they're going to expand their operations. And I'm contending, and one of the reasons why we've done better than most people have thought we've done is because we actually have a pretty good educational system here. It's better than other places in the country. We just need to make it even better, and we need to fine-tune it to make sure the kids are heading in the right direction. So when you look at competitiveness, do American manufacturers believe that they can be competitive? And they do. In fact, today they believe they're competitive. 41% of them believe, and even a greater number in the future believe that we can be competitive. This was the North American study, so both those in Canada and Mexico also believe they can be competitive. So it's not as if it's all doom and gloom, and the major manufacturers themselves don't believe they should be in the United States. We still have the largest market in the world, and that's one of the reasons why we still have one of the largest manufacturing sectors, though most of it's business to business, not to consumer. As we all know, it's very hard to find American-made products in most of our stores, but most of the planes you fly on and other industrial products that get made, many of them are made in the United States. So let's talk about growth. Where does growth happen in the manufacturing sector? And this has been true for some time, and it'll be true as we come out of this recession. Small, medium manufacturers are really the growth sector. They're the ones you want to incentivize, you want to grow in your community. About 95% of all firms are small to medium, and they categorize at the federal level up to 2,000. I would consider them almost large for our community. They employ about 50% of the employees, about 37% of all the receipts, and $1 trillion per year. So these are very important, very productive, and incredible companies for our community. And actually the rest of the country. And about 60% of our manufacturers are in the small to medium. So that's good news for New York State. It's one of the reasons why I believe we've been more competitive, and we are actually more competitive today. If you look at the statistics through the end of the year, we've actually fared better than the United States when it's come to job loss in the manufacturing. We've lost jobs, but we're doing better than the nation as a whole. Pennsylvania, our neighbor, which has tended to do better than us in the past, has a higher loss of manufacturing jobs than we did. In comparing us to Massachusetts, we had higher than Massachusetts. And I'd like to use Pennsylvania and Massachusetts in some ways, because Massachusetts has made a significant shift to the high-tech manufacturing sector. They do incredibly well. And they had about a 5.5% job loss in manufacturing. New York State had about 7.5%. Pennsylvania had close to 9.5%. So you can see that we've actually, I believe, as a state, turned the corner. We have a lot more work to do, but we didn't lose as many jobs in this last recession. We did better than the nation as a whole, and we did better than our regional competitors in some ways. The real question in my mind is, are we going to grow out of this recession? If we pick up jobs and grow out of the recession, then we'll be further ahead, and there have been periods when we've done that. In fact, during the mid-90s, we grew about 5,000 manufacturers' jobs here from about 95 to 2000. And we did that, as you might remember, because the state took a whole series of actions to cut regulation, cut taxes, made incentives, and created programs to help manufacturers grow again. So I think we can do it, and I think we've demonstrated we can do it, but we still have a lot of work to do. Now, what about Central New York? Well, you may have remembered the Patel study that was done a few years ago, and it's still relevant today. And they identified five sectors that they believed were growth sectors: biosciences, digital electronic devices, environmental systems, packaging, precision metalworking. These were the top five. They're all manufacturing. The reality is we have significant clustering in these areas, 670 establishments, 39,000 people working in them, or at least connected to manufacturing. Obviously, they're beyond that. And nearly 10% of the total regional output, employment, is in these clusters. And they have grown significantly faster than the normal growth in the private sector employment, about 17.6% growth when the normal employment was 3.5%. We have significant clustering, about 40% above the average in these areas vis-a-vis the rest of the country, and about four times more environmental systems. Our large engineering firms are in the environmental systems area. So these are the clusters in the manufacturing sectors, high-tech, advanced manufacturing, where we can grow. We have significant strength, and because they're clustered here, they give us the opportunity to grow them. So we have fertile ground and fertile opportunity with these clusters. And I am actually and have seen over the years growth in these clusters, and I think that our Center of Excellence and even the Biotechnology Center, which actually had an event here this week, are significant advancements to help us grow in those two key areas: biosciences, environmental systems, energy systems. I want to share a little bit now with you of what our members are thinking. We do an annual survey about what issues they're concerned about. We also now do one statewide, as Stanford mentioned. We created the Manufacturers Alliance about 3 years ago, which is a grouping of organizations like ours, us being the largest across the state, and we had about 1,000 companies in it, and they have similar results. But I'm going to share Central New York's results with you. So what are the major issues at the federal level that our manufacturers are concerned about? Energy policy was the first, followed closely by healthcare, and healthcare primarily in terms of cost. And that's probably the big unknown about healthcare reform. How much will it cost more? And how much will it cost? Because the high-tech sector, the manufacturing sector, for the most part, offers healthcare. It's not an access question. It's a question of cost. And they are very concerned about cost increases. One member said to me just this week, their estimate is their premiums could go up 40%. I hope that's not anywhere close to reality. So cost is a huge issue. In part because other parts of the world have either lower health care costs or they're covered under a program where they don't have to pay them. In Canada, for example, they don't pay health care costs when you make a manufactured product. Investment in manufacturing, a big issue. Fair trade, fourth issue. Tort reform continuing to be an issue. And then technology policy encouraging domestic consumption and then the all-important other category. So our policies and our focus from an advocacy standpoint at MACNI has been, how do we get a fair trade policy? We have supported Senator Schumer and his attempt to confront the Chinese with their devalued currency by a need to let it float and allow for the currency to moderate. That has a huge impact. It can have as much as a 40% impact on the cost of goods. So that's a very significant piece of legislation, and we're hoping the Obama administration, which as a candidate president, the candidate Obama talked about doing something here, so we're hopeful that we'll see some action there and that the Congress, I know the Congress has woken up. I remember going there about 2004, 2005 and trying to put the issue on the agenda with this group of others around the country. It's now starting to get its fair hearing. I mentioned lowering business costs. They're incredibly concerned, and so our priorities have been around making sure we get a healthcare cost reduction as well as maintaining access. Better tax policies, cost-cutting reforms. We need a comprehensive energy strategy that also lowers the cost for energy. We have some of the highest cost of energy on the globe. That's a problem for us. The way we do cap and trade is going to be incredibly important to the manufacturing sector if we place it on the backs of manufacturers. We'll see job loss because they'll go someplace else in the world, so we need to do that right. And of course, we talked about investment. There's one bill in particular that we're very concerned about. It's the sort of the specifics of the so-called Employee Free Choice Act. We're concerned about how it would be implemented and how it would have a tremendous impact, we believe, on employment in New York State. What are state policies or state priorities, that they're focused on? The number one is health care. Again, a big cost. New York State has some of the highest cost health care in the country. We'll need to continue to work on that. Taxes, workers' compensation, even though we had a reform bill a couple years ago, it's an ongoing task to make sure we have a reasonable increase, and we'd like to see some decreases in workers' comp costs. Budget reform continues to be a priority issue. Manufacturers and business leaders are just as frustrated with our systems in Albany as the regular population. And Albany reform in general, their energy policies in there at number five. So one of our key focuses is lowering the costs of doing business in New York State, starting with taxes and health care costs, workers' comp, I mentioned those. We need a long-term energy program. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. We have a long-term energy program that allows manufacturers to take advantage of our low-cost hydro. In fact, we'll allow them to stay here and to be competitive. And we continue to advocate for investments in the workforce. I mentioned, I believe that's probably the biggest crisis ahead of us, along with continued incentivization of investment in technology. That's manufacturing today. I'm willing to take any of your questions. Thank you for having me.
When, Randy, you talked about the workforce crisis. Are there any organized efforts by MACNY or the Manufacturers Alliance to work with whoever it is we need to work with to change the education focus?
Yeah, we've been doing work within high schools. Actually, I think the big opportunity is locally within high schools in helping prepare students for the work that's ahead of them. We're working with several groups and have some focused efforts on getting teachers into the workplace. I mean, many teachers have spent their entire careers in the teaching environment, and they've never been in the modern workplace. They haven't gone to a Census or a Welsh Allen, and they haven't seen the technology that is being used and the skill sets necessary. So getting teachers and administrators into the workplace and getting young people into the workplace to start to considering in the middle school years as well as early high school, well, maybe I do have a technical aptitude or a science math aptitude, and these jobs do exist. And I think one of the biggest challenges is many of the manufacturers, you hear about them maybe, and you drive by them, and you really don't know what goes on because they're not advertising for a local audience. You know, they're not trying to promote their product. So it's very difficult to get the exposure, especially for a small company, that's necessary when it comes to hiring. So I have seen a considerable increase in the interest of business leaders and actually employees within companies to get into the high schools, to get into the, go to those places. To have young people get excited. I went to, recently, a robotics competition in Rochester. It was like a high school football event or a basketball event. It was engineering teams from across the state, 30 of them, and they had a three-day competition just to make engineering exciting, to have the same kind of level of excitement. And I think that's part of the need is we have to do a lot more in educating young people. We do have some efforts, but there needs to be more efforts, and I know there's a lot of people working on this issue, but we need to continue to make.
Okay.
Randy, to what extent is MACNY and the companies that belong to MACNY addressing the issues of sustainability and cradle-to-cradle manufacturing?
Well, it's become the mantra of any manufacturer today. Nationally, our manufacturers are incredibly environmentally conscious. They have some of the most sophisticated facilities in the world, and every company is going to be getting and is becoming greener. It's just a question of the pace and the speed. And when people talk about green jobs, I like to talk about every job being greener because there's not a job, especially in the manufacturing sector, that doesn't have to find new ways to reduce cost and to reduce waste, and all of that saves money. So the trend is already in that direction. I think a good deal of our conversation is about the rest of us catching up, because for years manufacturers have had tremendous incentive to lower their waste and to reduce cost because those are costs that are imposed. So it's not a company that I'm aware of that isn't focused on some way becoming greener. They're looking at alternative energies. Because of the cost issues, those steps have been increased. And I think also you're seeing renewed interest in our community because of the Center of Excellence and now the Biotechnology Center. People are making those kinds of investments. So I'm really excited about that trend, and I think it will help our manufacturers significantly.
Randy, as you're probably aware, the MDA and the Chamber of Commerce have decided to speak to each other and become one. Now we've got MACNY out there as another one of the economic development tools. in this community, and I wonder how the merger of those two organizations affects what you do, and when will you become part of that group?
Yeah, good question. The merger of the two organizations, I've known and worked with Darlene and Rob and their predecessors for some time. So the dialogue has been there for quite a few years, actually, in terms of working together. So the reality is that I think it was probably a long-term process that took multiple years to accomplish. But the reality is I do see, and Rob and I talk frequently, about how that transition is occurring, and we're obviously very supportive. We've been in ever since I've been at MACNY, we've had nearly monthly conversations about how do we make sure we're collaborating, how do we make sure our programs don't overlap, so we don't do things that they do and they don't do things that we do. As you heard from Stanford, our regional imprint in terms of who we serve is significantly larger. We're now in 20 counties, and we continue to grow every year. And we really serve the manufacturing sector, the high tech in manufacturing sector, and we've done so throughout our 97 years of history. What we're seeing is continued growth within the state. We now are the voice for manufacturing in New York State. And through the alliance, we see our continued footprint to be New York State. In fact, one of the groups added last year was from Long Island. So we really have representation from across. We're now in 45 counties through the alliance. So we see our approach both regional, continued, very specific services to manufacturers and high-tech companies, and then increasingly serving the entire state. We are the largest manufacturing group in the state of New York. So our focus will be manufacturing, high-tech, these kinds of issues that affect high-tech in manufacturing, and we'll continue to collaborate with all kinds of groups to make sure that happens. One of the big missing elements that we've noticed in New York State is there is no statewide group until just recently. 3 years ago, we created one because there wasn't a statewide group to focus on growing manufacturing. And what we found is a lot of energy in that because manufacturing still, one, has a very important impact in our state. And it's important that Albany see that. We've had our third manufacturing day. It went away, by the way. There was no manufacturing day in Albany. So you'd have lots of groups going to Albany talking about their needs, but there weren't any high-tech manufacturers walking around the halls. So we did that this year, our third one, and we had 85 CEOs and presidents talking about the issues necessary to grow manufacturing. So there's not a group that does that until 3 years ago, and we see that as our role, stepping into that vacuum of communicating the need for manufacturing, the growth in manufacturing, and helping come up with effective policies and services to serve them. So I think that the recent merger will strengthen our community in many ways, and I see great promise there, and we'll continue to be partners in that effort. I don't see MACNY becoming a part of that effort because of our both specific focus and our statewide focus.
To go back to the student's choice again, you spoke of trying to get more students to consider these two-year associate degree programs rather than going to college. Well, if you are in one of those programs and you get a job at the end of one of those programs, can you really earn a middle-class, upper middle-class wage, or do these people find themselves in the position of having to go back to college and upgrade? I mean, an engineer requires more than a two-year certificate. So is it realistic to expect people to choose jobs that may pay half or a third of what a professional job might
pay? No, if they paid half or a third, but they don't. They pay more, actually. The technology jobs that I'm talking about will start in the mid-50s, two-year degrees. There are jobs right now open. If you're a welder or a production worker in a specific kind of industry, you can make $30,000, $40,000 a year. You can get on a path to management. I mean, the reality is the path is there. It exists. It's not for every kid, but my sense is that, and I've seen this and heard this, that people don't believe that the career path exists, and they think that they're minimum wage paying jobs. I mean, the average job in many of our companies range between $15, $20, $25 an hour. I mean, those are very good paying jobs with benefits, by the way. So the reality is that these are jobs worth having. They're just not well known about. Though they need some form of college. I mean, they do need probably a two-year degree to be productive and to have an advancement. Some of that will be paid for by the employer. So it's a very cost-effective mechanism as well. You know, as I was talking to Debbie Sadow just the other day, you know, in some ways it's better to find out what you'd like to do with your life at $3,500 a year than it is at $35,000 a year. So I think there's a realistic expectation is there are jobs available. They pay incredibly well, but they're hidden. People don't know about them. And so young people that would have those aptitudes don't even know they exist, and that's a problem.
Is there also, Randy, is there any gender bias that, you know, that these are jobs for boys? You know, you mentioned welding or whatever. Is there...
They're probably more perception issue than anything. But no, there isn't. I mean, you walk around the modern manufacturing facility today, the gender, you know, there's no barriers and limitations.
Hopefully I'm not addressing something you already talked about, but does MACNI or any of the specific companies offer any kind of financial incentive to entice students in high school to go through specific two-year programs and then obtain work with them if they pay for the college education?
No, there's not any programs that I know of that would incentivize. And I think it's one of the things that we need to continue to look at is what will it take to get young people to actively consider careers in the science technology sectors, which is really a growth sector and will continue to be a growth sector. So I do think we need to relook at our incentives, and we need to find a way to encourage them. There are, like I said, a whole group of engineering companies that have created competitions and actually have encouraged students to consider engineering careers. But the other technology careers are a lot it's been harder to aggregate, though the incentives, it's been harder to access those things. But I think it's coming because businesses can't find them. So they're looking for ways to be more engaged. So I think there's really a renewed interest that had gone away for probably a couple of decades. And in fact, part of our problem is our apprenticeship programs, they're no longer around. You can't take an apprenticeship program for the most part to do the kinds of jobs we're talking about. And they have to be brought back into existence. And one of the big difficulties here is when we had large companies, you know, you could aggregate them. You could put 20 people through a welder's class. Well, now you have a disaggregated workforce, and you have companies that are all 100 or 50. And it's much harder to aggregate the numbers. So we've had these conversations, but we're going to have to find a better solution because we can't do without them anymore.
During the coming year, what are the top two priorities your organization is going to try to accomplish?
Well, we have more than two. I understand. That's a good question. What we're focused on right now is we sort of have two focuses. We focus directly on helping companies find the resources or be in touch with the resources that are necessary for them to be successful. About a third of our members are non-industrial who serve the serve the industrial sector. They become great assets, and we do services directly. So helping them mitigate and navigate the difficult economy is always our number one priority because we're a member association. Our second priority continues to be how do we influence Albany? You know, how do we make, and many times we're just stopping things from happening. You don't read about them because they don't happen. How do we make sure bad things don't happen as we're recovering from our economy? We obviously need to see a good budget. We need a long-term energy program. We need an extension of the QETC tax credits. So there's a whole series of public policy initiatives at the state level that we're focused, along with other business groups, to make sure that they happen or other bad things don't happen. So help companies be successful, help them in a whole variety of areas, and then specifically try to work collectively with them to mitigate impacts at the state level. And we also do some federal work, but our voice isn't nearly as strong there.
To piggyback on that, you talked about needing incentives to grow manufacturing, as you said, out of this recession. Are you talking about things like the Empire Zone?
Yeah, we definitely need... Yeah. Well, it was a mixed bag, but actually incredibly important for the state during its inception. We need an Empire Zone-like program without the problems. We can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's be honest. We can't be competitive if we don't have a solid economic development program. And it has to not only work on attraction, it's got to work on retention. And if we need to keep existing high-tech companies here and growing. So the Empire Zone had its problems because there were loopholes that were created, and then people drove trucks through them, and they weren't closed. And then, of course, businesses get blamed for doing that when the loopholes were created and they weren't closed. So the reality is a good number of companies were able to invest, and that's what you want. A good economic development program, I think, has certain key elements. It encourages investment. specifically capital investment. It's really difficult to move that factory or that facility when you, you know, someplace else. So encourage capital investment. It's got to encourage job growth, but the right kinds of job growth. Job growth that's above the median average, because that's the kind of jobs you're trying to create, and they tend to have spin-off jobs. You know, it needs to be flexible. Let's try not to do all things in one program. We need a program for urban redevelopment. We don't have one. There's not one on the table right now. That's not good. So let's put one on the table. Let's have a program for attraction, because it will do different things to bring companies into the state. And then let's have a program for retention. So let's. One of the big problems with the Empire Zone is we started with one thing, and then we just kept morphing it. We added more things to it, and it became all things to all people, and then nothing to all of us. And it became, you know, the great villain. So let's not go down that path. So we have to have a very good economic development program in order to drive investment. I think the one that's being proposed by the governor is a good one, just not enough. We need to spend probably about $500 million a year out of a $132 billion budget, which, by the way, is not a lot of money, to help grow our economy. So we need to spend more than the $50 million that's on the table. We need to I don't know how much we need to spend, but certainly more than that, and it needs to have more investment, and it needs to encourage investment. Because if we don't do that, the states of Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and North Carolina, they're going to get the next round of investment. This is a very competitive business, and we need to be in the game. So Empire Zones, we'll call it something else. I'm sure when we get a new governor, there will be a no program, because there always is when you get a new governor, no matter who the governor is. So the reality is we need strong economic development programs. We need to really watch costs, imposing new costs on businesses, especially existing businesses, because they look at their competitive situation. Invest in capital and invest in growth, and also invest in workforce. We need to continue to make our workforce development programs at the state and federal level better, more accessible, not so out of the reach of so many companies, because really the investment in the workforce is a critical component. We need to continue to work on education.
Randy, you mentioned that manufacturers are reaching out to teachers and students to come visit them to see what they do on their sites. But the other side of the coin is I think most manufacturers do not have a public face in our community. And I have a couple thoughts on that that I'd like your reaction to. One is to have a giant job fair for manufacturing only, and also to have exhibitions of what their processes are, what their products are, so the public and the students, young people, can actually see what's going on in the manufacturing section. Is this something that is feasible?
Let me start with the latter one. I think it's certainly feasible, and I see more and more companies doing it, and we're encouraging it. And the schools are being much more open and receptive to it, too, because it takes both sides. It takes the education system to really honor and welcome and find programming and make time in the schedule to do it. And we know they're under tremendous stress to meet other requirements. So it really requires an educational system that's open to the conversation. Bringing businesses into the schools and going out to see businesses, and that's what I think can have the biggest impact. And one of the reasons why guidance counselors and teachers become so critical is because they become the role model in the classroom about what is relevant in the world. So one of the best ways is to get teachers, administrators, and guidance counselors into facilities, high tech facilities, to see what's going on. So all of that is feasible when it comes to, we just need to do more of it. So we're focused on doing that. We've got several initiatives that we're working on, along with working with other community players here. So yes, very doable, necessary, and I think required. In terms of job fairs, what's interesting is the job market for manufacturers, many of them are one and two jobs. So the real and they change. So the difficulty is putting a job fair together that would have relevance. And what you don't want to do is put, especially in this economy, to have someone line up with a long line for one job. And more importantly, it has certain technical specifications. The problem is they're not just any jobs, they're jobs with special requirements. So they literally could go to a job fair and see absolutely no one who has the job requirements. So trying to improve and continue to work with the existing job system is what has been our focus and companies' focuses. The WIB is focused on being the local one-stop for employment. Companies do have their vehicles and mechanisms for getting out and finding those in the community. But the real challenge is just isn't the right people with the right skills. And that's where we're heading. We need to get more people into the skill sets. So the first one you mentioned is a tough one to get our arms around. There are, in fact, manufacturers sometimes have job fairs either individually or collectively, but we haven't been very productive at it.
Randy, I missed earlier part of your talk, so I hope I'm not repeating, but as one of the few manufacturers in this room, I'd like you to stress what good training you offer for the manufacturers here. You have OSHA programs, you have LIFT programs, you have incredible, and we take advantage of a lot of it, plus the HR help that we get. And I also thought that we're missing BOCES. BOCES does a great job in providing manufacturers with trained welders and grinders. Welding and grinding is a skill. It's an art, and it takes a lot of practice. And also the new CNC machines that they're coming up with, and these are machines that you put a piece of metal in, and it shapes it and grinds it and puts a hole in it. They all have all new programming technology to them, and they do need a lot of training. You're definitely right. There's a great area of growth in these fields, and they are well-paid jobs.
I couldn't have said it better, actually. Thank you for making those comments, because you're absolutely right. Those are the areas where we need emphasis in terms of where the jobs are, the types of skills necessary, and your company's a great company in this community, a long period of time providing great service. Thank you for doing that. And it really is upon the backs of these manufacturers and the companies to grow our community, and you've done a great job. And that's our part. You know, we're partners with the companies providing OSHA training, very specialized training. We're not doing other types of training because that's not our niche, but we'll do very specific manufacturing or technology-focused training, and we do make an impact there, and thank you for saying that.
Randy, you identified this job situation in terms of people not perceiving that there are jobs out there, and the whole thing, what you've identified is a tremendous disconnect in the system. And as I hear you talking about the priorities of the Manufacturers Association, I don't hear that coming up toward the top of the list. If that's the biggest problem in the future, is having a workforce, I've spent the last 10 years helping people on the South Side, and they don't have a clue that there's anything out there. They're living lives of hopelessness, and this information needs to get out to the grassroots of this community so that the kids will see that there's some point in staying in school and going up to OCC or wherever to get the training that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, I've had probably 10 conversations in the last month about this with key players in the system, and we do have specific initiatives. We have an emerging workers grant, actually, with some of the individuals in this room. It's almost a $500,000 grant that's focused on identifying and actually providing certificates for production and welding. So we're actually working on very specific solutions, as well as trying to generate a community-wide conversation about the need here. So I think the hardest part of this issue is no one organization by itself can fix this, or even begin to put real solutions on the table. So it will take the community collaboration and many partners and players in order to alleviate this issue. So we're a part of that conversation, and we actually do our specific roles, and we're interested in doing even more, as evidenced by the Emerging Worker Grant that we recently won as a part of a collaboration. That's an exciting grant because it took three grants and created a common intake, the first time New York State has seen that. So I think we're being collaborative and creative, and we were one of the Genesis partners to say, yeah, we don't want to create a separate intake. Let's have a single intake that we can use when the grant is finished for all kinds of training for unemployed workers. So we think we're working hard on it, and we know that others are working hard on it. And one of the reasons why I'm here, and I do talk about it, I mean, as you can see, I could talk about 100 issues, and I could, you know, there are lots of them. But I always place this at the top because it's the one that needs to be worked on. It's something we can actually do something about. I can't usually fix national energy policy. Talk about it till I'm blue in the face, can't do much about it. I still talk about it, but the reality is this workforce place, everywhere I go, I talk about it. And everywhere we go, we're trying to work on something. I had a conversation yesterday with Central Tech principal about how do we get internships. We need young people to do an internship in high-tech facilities. Why aren't there 11th graders at Census? Well, education policy has to be changed. We don't allow people to go into these facilities and work until they're 18. What's wrong with that? I mean, in Germany, they don't have that problem. You know, we've got to get young people into the facilities when they're 14. So we've got a real disconnect on energy policy and when it comes to education policy. They don't connect with the world we're living in. So the biggest problem is there's so many pieces here to get right. And they've been out of alignment for so long. Because we didn't need these skilled laborers, because we had a really declining need. Now we got an increasing need. We got to change our entire focus, and it's becoming clearer in every day. So, if you hear me speak in the future, you'll probably again hear the same talk, or at least similar talk, and it'll have a huge emphasis on workforce. But I think we do have to involve all community partners. That's why the Emerging Workers Grant was put together the way it was, and we'll continue to do that because, as many of you know, that. You know, part of my passion is in the not-for-profit community. I spent 3.5 years at the Samaritan Center. I know there's a workforce development need. So I like your passion. I share it. And we're doing as much as we can, and we're always looking for new opportunities.
Is there any way to connect all of the effort that's being put into Say Yes to Education, with the focus on higher education, to whatever we want to call this, job training, or also education, and not just say it's not college, but you know, why? It depends on how you define college, I guess.
I mean, that's kind of the way I think most people are now hearing it, is let's not define college as a four-year degree. Let's define college as, you know, post-high school, and that may be a two-year degree or a four-year degree or a six-year degree, or it may be just certificate training. It's college or it's education beyond high school. It's not enough to have a high school education anymore. You need education beyond. I think my big concern is that we're overemphasizing that, and people hear college, they think four-year institution. But the largest institution in the community right now in terms of undergraduates has become OCC. Most people don't know that. 12,000 undergraduate students up there, as large as SU now. That's great news. And we have a very dynamic leader at OCC. Debbie Seidel is outstanding, and we have a great community college. If every community college in New York State was doing what OCC was doing, our problem would be a lot closer to being solved. And that's the good news in our community. I'm always constantly amazed, but not so much anymore. Because I see it every day. Just the tremendous amount of work that's being done in this community. Leaders like Debbie Seidel and many, many others that are really making an impact. So I'm very optimistic about the future. When I first got this job, I took the job in October of 2001. Really the worst time to go and work in a manufacturing association. And I will tell you, I've never been more optimistic about our future. I'm incredibly convinced that we can be successful on this workforce development issue, too, because I've seen collaboration and the kinds of things that I just wasn't seeing the first time I stepped into that office.
One of the questions I have is around planning for the future. We have jobs now that we need to get workers that match those jobs. The dilemma, though, is some of those jobs in 5 years going to disappear. So are we preparing young people for jobs that will disappear, especially with the growth in technology? So how do we deal with that issue of we have jobs now that, in fact, might not be there 5 years, so why should I bother?
How do we plan? Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I'm dealing with it right now with my own daughter. She's a senior in high school. And, you know, I look at the world today and when I was looking at college, and it's a world of difference, thousands of potential choices, thousands of colleges. You know, I looked at five, that kind of thing. But the reality is we do have to prepare them for jobs that we don't know will exist. But we have some sense of what kind of jobs are going to exist. We know that they'll be technology-focused. We know that many of them will be heavy in math science. So, you know, one of the things we have to do is have our high school children take math science. They may not like pre-calc. They need it. I mean, I was just at Tech Central, and we were talking about the curriculum for the culinary arts. They have pre-calc as a requirement, necessary. So we need to prepare our young people foundationally with a heavy dose of real important academic preparation. I mean, one of the biggest complaints you hear from community college presidents is the kids don't come prepared. And that's a problem. They need to leave high school prepared to go into their advanced training. So we need to do the foundational issues, because then no matter what career you're going into, the other thing we need to understand is most young people will have seven careers, not jobs, careers. So they're not going to get an education that prepares them for the rest of their life. I mean, that's kind of how I thought when I went to college, I'd get enough education and then I wouldn't have to worry about it again. Not true. They're going to be career learners. So I think the whole lexicon has to change about being a career learner, finding a series of careers, foundational skills, and then they'll be ready. I'm already in my fourth career. I never expected to be in my fourth career. I've been in the Army, not-for-profit sector. So the reality is I think we're all going to need to be much more flexible. And the jobs we have today are really precursors of tomorrow's jobs. What you see, if you look at a main, even one of my members today, the jobs change all the time, but it's primarily incremental. It's always new technology. So you pretty much know that it's a steep learning curve for technology. You have to have foundational math science skills, and you got to work well with others. I mean, even the basic employer pleasing skills are necessary. Show up for work on time, work well with others. Those things haven't changed. So even though the world has changed, it's changed, I think, in a direction that's predictable. Yeah, but reality is I can't tell you specifically what the job title will be, but I think we can tell you the kinds of skills you'll need to be successful. And I think that's the conversation we have to have about skill sets, skill assessment. One of the big problems I have is we don't assess skills. We have to do much more skill set assessments. Employers want to hire someone with the right skill set. The degree is not that important to them. The label is not as important as, do you have the skills necessary to be successful? We've gotten a lot better at that, too. We have companies now that literally test you on your skill sets before they'll hire you, because they don't care what you've got on your resume. They want to know, do you have the skills that you will need to be successful? So we have a lot of good new tools, I think, that help us, too. I wish I had a better answer for the question other than it is part just seeing where we're at and where we're going.
That's a great answer and a great place to end. Thanks, Randy.